Play and stay on Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. Stand up paddleboarding, hiking, great restaurants and breweries. I'll tell you more about your next vacation destination later in the show.
Cairo, Seattle.
I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, a show about famous people and the stories behind the foods they love most. Today on the program, one of my favorite musicians, Iron and Wine.
My father built a mansion on the mountain.
You're listening to Iron and Wine with Calexico from their new album, Years to Burn.
She said the weather's never fair, the wind can only blow your hair.
Iron and Wine sounds like a band, but it's actually one man. His name is Sam Beam. It was some kind of supplement, is that right?
Yeah, I found this stuff on the shelf called Beef, Iron, and Wine, you know, just passing through the shelf. It's just like, what a strange collection of words.
Sam's last meal is so southern and so summery, it's going to make you homesick for last week. You know, last week, when it was still summer. And I called on a couple of North Carolina's most knowledgeable food sources, chef, author, and TV personality Vivian Howard, and food journalist Kathleen Purvis.
When you're a North Carolina food writer, people are usually asking you about pimento cheese, barbecue, or tomato sandwiches.
We are going to talk about the latter. And we'll learn the history of boiled peanuts with culinary historian Robert Moss. But first, my interview with Sam Beam of Iron and Wine.
We read the writing on the wall, braced each other for the fall. There's only one way up a mountain after all.
Most famous artists, whether they're actors or musicians, have a very similar rags-to-riches story. They were struggling artists for years. They lived in cramped apartments with too many roommates. They played to empty clubs. They worked as bartenders and babysitters to pay the rent. All of this until they finally got their big break. But Sam's story is completely opposite of that.
I know, it was kind of embarrassingly easy. I hate to repeat it because it's just embarrassing when I talk to my friends who work so hard. But I'll tell you anyway.
Okay. I'm here to embarrass you.
Yeah, I would. Okay, it's easy to do sometimes.
Sam was a professor of film and cinematography at the University of Miami.
Yeah, I was teaching, but I always liked music. I mean, I had gone to art school and then ended up doing film work and was, you know, just one of those creative types who likes to dabble in lots of things, has a hard time focusing on one. And music was one that I was doing in my spare time. But a friend of mine, Ben Bridwell, who has a band called Band of Horses, we grew up together in Columbia, South Carolina, and we had, you know, bonded on music over the years. We were keeping in touch and sending each other things that we were working on. And he was living in Seattle at the time and had a band called Carissa's Weird. And they were talking to Sub Pop about putting their record out. And he just put my stuff in their ear. He said, "Lear, you should check out my friend's music." And they called me. I was a fan of Sub Pop record. I mean, obviously all the Nirvana stuff and Red Red Meat, and all these great records. And so I was, shocked. I mean, are you sure you're the right number? I mean, just given what the music I was making, it didn't really resonate in my mind as what Sub Pop would be interested in, but I was definitely flattered by the call.
He wasn't even trying to be a professional musician. He was just trying to make music because he loved it. And then, he just gets a call one day from Sub Pop, which is the label that first signed Nirvana and Soundgarden and later signed bands like The Postal Service, The Shins, Sleater-Kinney, Flight of the Conchords, and past Your Last Meal guests, Taco Cat. So 2 months after Sam signs with Sub Pop, they just send him out on tour.
We just got cracking. It was interesting. Just one of those moments where your life takes a turn or gives you an opportunity that you had never expected. And if you're willing to jump in, it might take you down the rabbit hole. And here I am, still in the rabbit hole.
Your music is so chill, so I was kind of delighted to read that you used to be a metalhead when you were young.
Yeah.
As was I. I was a Pantera shirt-wearing, chain wallet kind of gal in high school.
They were great, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was always kind of a musical omnivore. I just like all kinds of music. I mean, it's like assuming that a chef in an Italian restaurant only eats Italian food or something.
Sam has 5 children, ranging from 9 to 21 years old. And when he's home, he loves to cook. So how do you accommodate all of their tastes and palates? What are some dishes that you can make for everybody?
Well, pizza is pretty popular. Yeah, they're all really different. That's always been a challenge, to be honest. I kind of just make things that I know that they like and then cook for myself as well. Part of being in a big family, everybody likes different things. But we also all bond on ice cream, so we always have a communal ice cream.
What are the 5 things that you rotate through?
Well, they love mac and cheese, they love spaghetti, they love pizza, they love chicken.
They sound like true American children, mac and cheese and pizza.
I know, the normals. Vegetables are still always a chore, but we try.
Some get lost in a storm, others behind an old chest of drawers. I feel God swallowed in fog, flowers and all.
What would your last meal be?
Oh, right. The reason that we're here. Well, I am from the Southeast, and one of the best parts about this time of the year in the summer, we're talking in the summer, is the heirloom tomatoes. And so tomato sandwiches are kind of like crack rock to me. I can't get enough in the summertime. Just the fresh summer tomatoes with like the cheapest white bread toasted and with some mayonnaise and lemon and a little spring onions or something. They're so good. It's incredible.
Oh, man. I just got a little drooly.
I know. It's incredible. You just can't, if you've had one, you know what I'm talking about. I would like a stack of those. And then I would also like boiled peanuts, which are also a kind of regional thing, which I grew up with boiled peanuts. It's kind of like a snack at like any like baseball game or any kind of like public function. It was just kind of a normal thing. I didn't realize until I got out and grew up and left that it was a really regional and unique and actually divisive snack. There's a lot of people who really don't like boiled peanuts, but I think they're incredible.
Can you explain to us Yankees what a boiled peanut is? Like, what's the texture and the flavor as opposed to the kind of standard ones?
Well, it's really soft. I mean, generally, you know, you eat them roasted with salt or something. But these, you take them green and you boil them, so they're soft, but they're really rich and sort of nutty in flavor. Some people just can't get past the texture. You kind of boil them in a brine, and now it's kind of popular to do them like a Cajun, like a hot peanut, and they're so good. And you can go and get them at any gas station. I mean, you know, take your life in your hands sometimes. At the same time, I think they're great. But, you know, it's just what I grew up with. And then to drink, I would demand white burgundy, the most delicious drink there is on the nectar of the gods from the Côte d'Or. And so that's my last meal.
Wow. So what is white burgundy like? What is the profile? And is there a certain brand that you like the best?
Well, I mean, I can't afford the stuff that I like the best, but I've had it poured for me before. They're just so balanced between the acid and the oak. It's just, I don't know. It's one of those wines where I can sit and just smell it and just be just as happy. I don't have to actually drink it. Just sit there and sniff on it all night. And it's such a pleasure.
So you're the cool guy in the corner just sniffing a glass.
I don't know how cool I am, but I'm definitely happy. But it's there's a reason it's so expensive. It's a reason it's the most popular grape in the world and everyone wants to make it. But it's a unique thing.
Sam Beam of Iron and Wine wants a summer heirloom tomato sandwich on white bread with mayonnaise, boiled peanuts, and a white burgundy for his last meal. He's a Southern boy with a flair for French wine. And Sam lives in North Carolina, where tomato sandwiches are a big deal. And people have big opinions about the right and wrong way to make one. For example, there is only one acceptable brand of mayo. There is one thing that you cannot put on the tomato sandwich. Actually, there are a ton of things that they will get so mad about if you put them on a tomato sandwich. And we're going to go through all of that after this quick break. If you're a fan of naturally gorgeous, off-the-beaten-path vacation spots with small-town charm, you're going to want to plan a visit to Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, where you can grab a scoop of homemade ice cream and stroll around the adorable European seaside village of Paulsbo, or walk on the ferry in Seattle and get off in downtown Bainbridge Island. And May is the perfect month to visit Bremerton or Silverdale, where you can get out of the city and into the forest in just 15 minutes for a beautiful hike. Enjoy a farm-to-table meal at Bremerton's Restaurant Lola, a Black-owned business. I really need to make the trip out there for their Creole brunch. And in the morning, stop by Saboteur Bakery for croissants that are so flaky and buttery, you'll think you're in Paris. There's also a gorgeous golf course in the middle of the forest, and there are several naval museums in Bremerton. Go to visitkitsap.com/yourlastmeal to learn more. That's K-I-T-S-A-P. Or you can find a link in the show notes. Play and stay on the Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. If you like listening to Your Last Meal, you might like watching my new TV show, The Nosh with Rachel Bell. We just wrapped up season one, so there are 4 tasty episodes ready for you to binge at cascadepbs.org. In episode 1, I convince an East Coast skeptic that Seattle now has fantastic bagels. And in the season finale, we go truffle hunting just about an hour outside of Seattle. Episodes are a quick bite. Just 8.5 minutes long. So grab a snack and cozy up with The Nosh. Available anytime, anywhere at cascadepbs.org or find a link in the show notes. Sam Beam wants a tomato sandwich for his last meal. Have you had an heirloom tomato white bread mayo sandwich this summer yet?
Oh, man, yeah, I have one. Like, when I'm home, I live in North Carolina, so there's a bunch of them around. Yeah, I have them, like, several times a week. I try to have so many that I get tired of them, so I'm ready for them to go away.
It's important that the tomatoes are super ripe and preferably from somebody's garden.
I'm not going to make a sandwich in December. You know, that's part of the fun of it, is that it's so seasonal, and so you have, it's like, you know, peaches or something, plums, summer plums. They're only ripe one time a year. And so you have to wait, and that's what makes it wonderful.
Now, I've watched people get a faraway look in their eye talking about the joys of a simple tomato sandwich during tomato season, but I had no idea that this was a thing in North Carolina. It's like a crawfish boil in Louisiana, or In-N-Out in California, or David Hasselhoff in Germany. Are they still into him? Is this still happening?
They still are,
they
and
still
they
love
will
him.
Always be.
I wanted to know more about the Southern tomato sandwich, so I called up Kathleen Purvis. She's a veteran food journalist in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The tomato sandwich all over the South is sort of the perfection of simplicity. The first thing that people try to do and do it wrong is they try to add bacon to it. It's not a BLT. It's not a bacon and tomato sandwich. It is strictly a tomato sandwich. And that means that you wait until the tomatoes are really good, which is later in the summer when it's very hot. You're suddenly flooded by tomatoes, and heirloom tomatoes all around here are a big deal. The second factor in that is the bread. For it to be a true tomato sandwich, it has to be white bread. And I know some people turn their nose up at it. Well, do you mean sourdough? Do you mean, you know, home-baked bread? Sure, if you want to get fancy. But honestly, most people get really into what they call bunny bread from the Merida Company. It is basically just your straight-on white bread. It's Wonder Bread. You know, that kind of pillowy, soft is what you want. You want the tomato juices to soak into the bread because it gives it kind of that gushiness factor. And then the third thing that's the most important thing is the mayonnaise. Yes, it has to be mayonnaise and just mayonnaise. You know, don't get fancy. Don't be adding anything else. And the mayonnaise, of course, in the South, the classic one that people will go to their graves fighting over is Duke's mayonnaise, which was invented in South Carolina by a woman named Eugenia Duke. It is still made and very, very popular in the South. And the trick with Duke's mayonnaise versus like Hellman's is that Duke's mayonnaise has no sugar in it. So it's a little bit more piquant, I think would be the right word. It's got a little bit of a tang to it. And of course, it's very creamy. And so the juices from the tomato mix with the creaminess of the mayonnaise, mix with the pillowiness of soft white bread. A good tomato sandwich, the juices need to roll down your arm to your elbow, and you probably should eat it standing over the sink. It's the kind of thing you would do if you've been working out in your garden all day. You're hot, you're tired, you just want to really appreciate your tomatoes. You make yourself a nice tomato sandwich, no bacon, no lettuce, and you stand over the sink and eat it. And that's like the epitome of a Southern summer evening.
What about salt?
Yes, absolutely. I'm always in favor of salt because salt will bring out the juices in the tomato. I put pepper on mine. I mean, old salt and ground pepper never hurt a thing.
This summer was the first time that I ever had a tomato sandwich. I didn't like tomatoes for most of my life, and I started liking them maybe like 10 years ago. And so it's kind of been like a slow crawl to want to just eat a big slab of tomato. But it was after I interviewed Sam and hearing him talk about it, I was like, I got to try this because I do grow heirloom tomatoes. And I had these huge orange heirlooms that took up the size of my palm. And I mean, they're so big that I made a salad with one of them and four people couldn't finish it. I mean, they're huge. So I got, I think, potato bread, and then I had the mayonnaise and the salt, and I was not prepared for how good it was. I just thought, it'll be fine.
There you go.
Made one, and then I immediately made another one, and then I made another one, and I was eating open face, so it was easier to kind of hork them down. But I ate three in a row the first time, and then I've been eating them ever since. They're so good.
Exactly. It's so perfect because it's so simple. And if you try and mess it up, if you try and fancy it up, it's not going to be right. It's an absolute celebration of summer.
About how many tomato sandwiches do you think you had this summer?
Probably 25.
That's Vivian Howard, North Carolina chef, restaurateur, cookbook author, and former host of the PBS show A Chef's Life. That's a good number.
Yeah, you know, one summer when we first discovered Cherokee Purples, I ate so many tomato sandwiches that I broke out in a rash around my mouth, I guess from the acid of the tomatoes.
Kathleen Purvis once wrote an article about a woman who had a tomato sandwich party, which apparently is something that you do in North Carolina. And some of her guests were not local. They had moved to North Carolina semi-recently. So they demanded lettuce. They wanted bacon on their sandwich. And the Charlotte Observer readers were incensed. They were so angry. This article garnered more comments, mostly angry comments, than any piece Kathleen had written in her decades-long career.
People can get very defensive about how their family made something. You're arguing with them. Well, you're really arguing with their grandmother, and how dare you do that? So all of these people attacked her. And the thing was, is she was in very bad health, and she knew she wasn't going to live to the following year. I went to do a follow-up on it, and the woman had died. And for her wake, I believe, her family did a whole tomato sandwich thing because she loved them so much.
Why were they mad at her? It sounds like it was her guests who were the problem.
Food arguments strike at the real base of who we are. It's the same thing we see with barbecue, same thing we see with pimento cheese. People will really get emotionally wrapped up in their food choices.
Hearing this, I was shocked to read that Vivian put a tomato sandwich on the menu at her restaurant, Chef and the Farmer. A tomato sandwich that strayed from the classic white bread and Duke's mayo formula. You make another version of the tomato sandwich with the Cherokee Purple tomatoes on onion bread with smoked corn aioli. So this is, you know, getting a little bit fancy, but I've only read good things. People have good things to say about this. So is it possible sometimes to sneak a chefy version through?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of what we're charged with as chefs who cook the food of our childhood. I certainly couldn't go to the store and buy Wonder Bread. If I had to choose between only having that sandwich with the smoked corn mayonnaise or a regular tomato sandwich for the rest of my life, I would still choose the regular tomato sandwich. But I am quite proud of what I did with the one at Chef and the Farmer.
Have you had another version in a restaurant that you liked?
No. The reason that you probably read about my gussied up tomato sandwich is because it's a rare thing to do in a restaurant setting.
It's interesting to me that it's such a Southern thing because it's not like you can't get these ingredients all over the country, and people grow tomatoes
exactly
all over the country too.
You know, I honestly, after I've been writing about Southern food in North Carolina for, you know, Lordy, 30 years. And one of the things I notice is that I don't think people don't do it in other places. They just don't celebrate it to the degree that we do. You know, people in the South didn't have a whole lot. Most of us are from pretty rural backgrounds. Our parents and our grandparents certainly were poor, even if we aren't. And so we tended to really celebrate and hang on to the things that were special to us. You look at something like pimento cheese or a tomato sandwich. These are very, very basic things. But they're so much a part of our identity, of who we are, that even though they might be made somewhere else, nobody defends them quite like we do.
I know that you know all about Southern food. One of the other things that Sam wants for his last meal are boiled peanuts. So I want to ask you about that.
Oh, Lordy, he's a man after my own heart. I love boiled peanuts. I was raised on boiled peanuts.
I was not raised on boiled peanuts, so it's been fun learning all about them. But I read a bunch of articles about the history of boiled peanuts and then learned that none of them were accurate. It seems it's another case of an African-American food that was eventually adopted by white people, and the history books gave them all the credit. Lucky for us, culinary historian Robert Moss knows the truth, and he's going to tell us all about the true history of boiled peanuts when we return from this quick break. Sam Beam wants boiled peanuts as a part of his last meal. And as I started doing research and reading articles about the history of this very Southern snack, I kept reading the same story over and over again. That boiled peanuts were eaten by Civil War soldiers out of desperation. That it was a cheap, protein-rich food that filled them up. These articles said that white Southerners invented the boiled peanut out of necessity in the early 1860s. But South Carolina culinary historian and food writer Robert Moss set the record straight in a super informative piece he wrote for Serious Eats.
Yeah, and first we'll start with the what's not the history, because if you Google it, you'll probably find some variation of a story that the boiled peanuts got started during the Civil War. Confederate troops had their supplies cut off, and they were so desperate they took to boiling peanuts, which up till then no one had eaten. You know, there was just some animal food or something, and they discovered they loved them, and thus the boiled peanut was born, which couldn't really be any further from the truth. That's not at all how people in the South started eating boiled peanuts. In fact, boiled peanuts were around long, long before the Civil War. And it's actually sort of a curious history, because the peanut itself is South American in origin. So it was found by Portuguese colonists when they were in Brazil. And then the Portuguese ended up taking the peanut to Africa, and the African groundnut was already a staple in the African diet. And they adopted the peanut and started growing it alongside it as sort of an alternate crop. And so peanut became really a staple of the diet in a lot of West African cultures. And then the peanut ended up being brought to North America via the slave trade, or colonial America, particularly in the Carolina colony. A lot of the slave Africans there would grow peanuts in their garden patches. So it was very much a part of their food ways, and it was something that was grown primarily for African families and then their descendants initially. It really wasn't until after the American Revolution that white Southerners sort of discovered the peanut and started cooking it as well.
In his article, Robert says the boiled peanut encapsulates not one, but all three of the most dangerous myths that run rampant in popular histories of Southern food. Number one, just about every Southern food was created or popularized during the Civil War, typically out of necessity and deprivation. Number two, everything Southern begins as an elevation of low common ingredients. And number three, nothing exists until white people discover it. Boiled peanuts were not a food of desperation for Civil War soldiers. They actually already loved boiled peanuts, and they couldn't get any during wartime. That story is even told in a wartime song called Goober Peas.
Which is a sort of one of these classic Civil War ditties, I guess you would call it. And it's all about soldiers who are reminiscing for home and missing eating peanuts. It's exactly the opposite. They don't have peanuts when they're in camp out in the field.
Goober Peas was a common nickname for peanuts back in the day.
And it actually comes from an Angolan word, N-G-U-B-A, guba, the Angolan word for peanut. And so that was sort of went from guba to goober. I guess even today, it's long been a nickname for peanut.
It makes sense that they call it a pea, because a peanut is not a nut. It's actually a legume, which is a very fun word to say. The peanut is a cousin to peas and beans. And boiled peanuts are made from fresh green peanuts that are harvested this time of the year.
Definitely very much a seasonal thing. Peanut harvest is usually somewhere between August and October, only lasts a couple of weeks. And those are truly green peanuts. Those are peanuts that have just been dug out of the ground, and they're raw. They have a lot of moisture in them, so they don't last very long. So they only last a couple of weeks, even refrigerated. So you can buy raw peanuts and boil them any time of the year. But the green peanuts, which make the best ones, are really only available for a couple of weeks in the late summer and early fall.
The natural moisture in the green peanuts is why West Africans started to boil them. They were too moist to be roasted.
If you haven't had one before, it can be a bit of an acquired taste because it's going to be soft. Both the shell is soft when you peel it, and then the pea inside, it's going to be a soft, salty kind of pea. It's not anything like what you might expect if you're used to eating roasted peanuts.
Let's check back in with Sam Beam. Like I mentioned earlier, Sam loves to cook, and he particularly loves Yotam Ottolenghi's cookbooks. Ottolenghi is a London-based Israeli chef who does magical things to vegetables, and both producer Laura and I are big fans of his recipes.
What do you like to listen to when you cook?
Honestly, it's like a great time to listen to music. I've gotten to a point in my life where silence is a commodity, too. I think it's just a occupational hazard. I'm not a very passive listener. It's kind of an active experience. It's hard because I like words, and it's hard to be concentrating on a task and also listen to the words, too. Like the car has become a hard time to listen to music for some reason because I get distracted, and that gets a little dangerous. But washing dishes seems to be safe enough. You can only cause so much damage if you're not paying attention. And so usually it's instrumental music. I listen to a lot of jazz or, you know, modern classical music.
And that was Sam Beam of Iron and Wine's Last Meal.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And it was an honor speaking with you. I'm a big fan.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Rachel. It's been a treat. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Man, don't you just love his speaking voice? It's so rich and relaxing and dreamy and warm. You can pick up his new album, the latest collaboration with the band Calexico. It's called Calexico and Iron and Wine, Years to Burn. They are on tour right now all the way through February in the U.S. and in Europe and in Canada. Go to ironandwine.com/tours. Thanks to award-winning North Carolina food journalist Kathleen Purvis. I think I'm already picking up all these people's accents.
I'm delighted to find out that he's got such good taste. Very, very basic and delicious things. What's his last drink, though? Did he say what he's going to wash those things down with?
He did, and it's interesting you ask because most people don't say a drink. He's one of the very few. He wants white burgundy.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I was surprised he didn't say iced tea. I figured he'd ask for a sweet tea.
I guess it's the highs and the lows. You have, like, you know, the simple, the peanuts, and then he wants this fancy wine, which honestly, I know nothing about. I'm not a wine person, and so he was saying it's the most wanted grapes in the world, and the bottle that he likes the most is too expensive for him to buy. And
well, good for him. And I do love that, you know, in his music, there's such a highs and a lows that actually kind of fits. And I appreciate him treating great, simple food with a very high-end wine, because a lot of times people don't think they belong together, and they do. They should be celebrated together.
Thanks to chef and author Vivian Howard. She has 3 restaurants in North Carolina and an award-winning cookbook called Deep Run Roots. Go to vivianhoward.com to learn more. And thanks to South Carolina food historian Robert Moss. We have covered all Carolinas on this episode. He is the contributing barbecue editor for Southern Living Magazine, and you can check out his cookbooks at robertfmoss.com. Your Last Meal was produced by Laura Scott and me, recorded with Aaron Mason, and theme music by Prom Queen. And a special thank you to Kyle Kellums at KUAF, public radio station in Fayetteville, Arkansas. I was in Fayetteville for the Roots Festival, which is a very cool food and music festival, when I got the alert that this Iron and Wine interview was going to happen. So I had to scramble, and KUAF was super generous and let me use their studio. Make sure you're following along on Instagram. I'm Your Last Meal Podcast. Subscribe, tell your friends, etc., etc. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal. And that was Sam. And that was Sam Beam of Iron and Wine's Last Meal.
You stumble over Sam Beam, but Yotam Ottolenghi.
I know.
No problem.
I know. I say that more often. It's important that the tomatoes are super ripe and preferably from somebody's garden.
Do you say preferably?
Is that not a word?
I would say preferably.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Preferably. Preferably.
Yeah.
Hmm. Is it a tomato-tomato? Sandwich-sandwich?
I see what you did.
That was not on purpose. Preferably. Yeah. They both sound right and wrong now.